While we're on our way to Psalm 77, I thought I would, we thought that might be a good lead-in to a person that probably would have had some connection with something very similar to what Rich just played. Because if you look at Psalm 77, it says in its beginning, to the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of Asaph. Asaph wrote a dozen of the psalms. He wrote Psalm 50 and then Psalms 73 through 83, so 12 in all. He was appointed a musician in the court of David, and we read this about him in 1 Chronicles 15, 19. So the singers Heman, Asaph, and Ethan were appointed to sound with cymbals of brass. He was a percussionist. So in honor of Asaph, I brought a cymbal up here tonight. Interestingly enough, cymbals are a very ancient instrument. Okay, I'm not going to play that. I'm not going to play that either. But this is a Zildjian cymbal. The Zildjian Company, for those of you that are drummers or drum aficionados, you know this. They're considered the finest cymbals you can buy, right? I'm looking at Rich, because if I get anything wrong, you correct me. But the company, the Zildjian Company, goes all the way back to, they're one of the oldest companies of any kind in the world, oldest maker of musical instruments. The company was founded in 1623 in what is now Turkey, what is Istanbul, used to be Constantinople. And the family were Armenian, and if you know anything about that history, how they were persecuted and all that sort of thing. So the family moved to Massachusetts in the 1920s, and the company continues on to this day and making cymbals. And so we think of a cymbal as, you know, in the modern days of jazz and that sort of thing. It's kind of a flashy instrument, that sort of thing. I will give you one just so you got to hear it, you know, just sound very kind of Eastern a little bit. But we were told that Asaph was a player of cymbals. They're mocking me now. That's what they're doing. But probably this is speculative because we know what a lyre probably sounded like, and that could be replicated because all music, all sound is made by vibrations passing through the air. And it could be made by a horn, for instance, a brass instrument. It's the vibration of the air blowing through. It's actually your lips that vibrate that make the vibration. Woodwind, it's a little sliver of wood called a reed. On the piano or a stringed instrument, it's that string vibrating, in this case, the keys that are there, or in this case, a piece of metal vibrating. But probably what they had tuned cymbals. So you'd have little tiny cymbals that were high and bigger cymbals that were low, and you could basically, with these cymbals, with two or three players, you could actually play a tune on the cymbals. And there are some places in modern music where that has been sort of replicated. Usually a cymbal is just, I always think of John Philip Sousa, you know, dun, 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 you know, that's kind of how we treat cymbals today. We just slam them together and make a big crash. But it reminds me of this, that of all the different instruments and all of antiquity and of today, they can all be blended together in a way that flows together and expresses something of emotion. And when we come to Psalms, I want us to make sure that we fully appreciate, or at least more closely appreciate, the fact that this is music. We don't have the annotation, so we can't play it out on an instrument today and that sort of thing, because their music would have been passed down by ear, just from a father singing it to a son and then to the next generation. That's how those tunes were passed down. How a lot of music here in Appalachia was passed down in those early days, those sort of the mountain music style. But we have for us the lyrics. So this cymbal player by the name of Asaph was a professional musician. It's what he did for a living. He was also a songwriter, as you see. And there's a few things you can see even in the beginning of this. And I'll just give you a few little tidbits before we get into the text. It says, the consoling memory of God's redemptive work. So that's a title that's been applied to give you a little clue what's coming. And then to the chief musician, to Jeduthun. That name is really, it may not sound like it, but it's a rather fairly common name throughout the Old Testament. Several people had that name. So he probably was that chief musician at the time. So it's either dedicated to him or it was presented to him. And oftentimes, even in popular music, you know, there's a songwriter that writes the song. There's the arranger that puts the arrangement together. And then there's a performer who actually sings it. So all of them sort of have a piece of the song, so to speak, if you want to say it that way. So He maybe was the arranger or the conductor or perhaps the one who sang, but it's given to him. Then if you look down at the end of verse 3, you see that little word at the very end of the verse that says Selah? Maybe we talked about this before. It's one of those words, this Hebrew word, we really don't have a completely, really firm grasp on exactly what that word means. It's speculated in many number of ways, but it appears 74 times in the Bible, so it's a term that we ought to pay attention to. Sadly, a few of the modern translations, because we don't know what it means, they'll just sort of leave the word out and then they put a little note at the bottom of the psalm, you know, some obscure word. Well, if it's in the text, we ought to leave it in the text, okay, and leave it there, even if we have trouble understanding it. One of the thoughts is that it is given to mark some sort of reading in the text. Some people believe it's an interlude from one music section to another, end of a verse or a chorus going to another. Maybe there was a musical interlude played, just sort of a pause. Sometimes it's viewed as a reflection it's sort of like an exclamation point. Pay attention to this. Think about this. Some people believe it may be like a rest symbol. If you know music, how there's, you know, a rest is built in to stop for a moment. So maybe it's a stop and pause. Whatever exactly it is, it's an indication to us, pay attention, wake up, look at what's being said. So it's every time I see it, I try to remind myself something important has come before and something important is coming after, and it's a moment to stop and reflect on both of those. So let's plow into our psalm for today and see what we can learn about it. I've entitled this study, The Way Out of Trouble. And we talked a few weeks ago about the different genres or categories of psalms. One of the things we talked about was a lament psalm, to be able to pour out one's sorrow, one's anguish, one's, you know, emotional hurt in a way. You know, and we know that in music today. There's songs that are sorrowful and sad. I remember someone saying once to me that a person that knows music said that probably the saddest song that's recorded in the last, 50-100 years was Hank Williams singing, "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry." You know, it's a lament. It's like life is just terrible, you know. I'm so sad and that sort of thing. So it has that sort of feeling to it. And you'll see that in the way this goes. Also, it's interesting that as he plows through this, it's interesting that he doesn't hold back his own feeling and his own difficulty and trouble. He begins with these words, "I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice. And he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord." So he says right at the beginning, troublesome day, not a good day, not a joyous day, not a happy day, not a zippity-doo-dah day. This is a troublesome day. I have trouble. I'm weighted down. I'm burdened, if you want to say it that way. He does the right thing in verse 2. "In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted." So he does the right thing. He does the right thing. He takes his troubles to the Lord. And I just want to flow with you through this passage because I think there's a certain progression that you see in his experience that he puts into poetry that was sung by them in song and now is left to us in the text of Scripture under the inspiration of the Spirit, who now we know this is to be not just the words of a man, although it is through the words of a man, but indeed it's the words of God to us. And he gives us some words that we could say, and he gives us some maybe some strategy or some way to flow through our own troubles and some advice that may help us because there's a certain progression. And as we look at this way through trouble, first of all, just understand this. The troubles of heart can lead us to God. They should lead us to God. We also know that it is possible that our troubles can lead us in the other direction if we allow it. It can lead us to despair. It can lead us to anger. It can lead us to rejecting our faith. It can lead us to all sorts of troublesome things. But it should lead us to God. Sometimes we should stop and say that our problems really are ways that God is somehow at work. And maybe we'll never quite figure out how this all fits. Maybe we'll never kind of get it all put together. And sometimes it just seems so overwhelming that we have trouble with it. But we know that somehow it is something of God's doing. In our family room, we have a puzzle that we started a few weeks ago, you know, picture puzzle with all the pieces. How long have we been working on that? About a month, maybe over a month. Do you think we'll ever get it together? More than once we said, maybe we should just put this one back in the box, okay? This is It's bigger than our usual puzzles, and it's complicated. We'll let you know if we get it finished, okay? But it's difficult to get all the pieces put together, and at some point it becomes frustrating rather than enjoyable, perhaps. But we understand that we can look at the box on the outside and see that's a nice looking picture there, and if we can get it together, it's going to be very nice. But that's how he looks at life. It just doesn't seem to fit. But we should just be able to say, this should lead us to God. And that's what these first six verses are all about. I love how he begins by saying, I know the Lord has given ear to me. I know he's listening. I don't doubt that he's there. I don't think he's not paying attention to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. Now, it gives us a little indication here of when it is he's praying, right? In the night. He is up. He's not sleeping soundly. He's not sleeping peacefully. He's not resting comfortably. He's indeed taking this to the Lord. It says, my soul refused to be comforted. There was nothing I could do to self-soothe my anguish of heart. He does not tell us what he's troubled about. It could have been a loss. It could have been some hurt, some betrayal. It could have been imagine what it could be. I'm actually, frankly, glad that he doesn't summarize it in great detail, because that makes it then all purpose. Whatever our troubles are, whatever we're going through, this is the right path to walk along with to find some help in that trouble. So he begins by praying. He's led to God. He goes and talks to God. He says, verse 3, I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. He's taken it to God. He's directing his thoughts to God, but indeed he's still troubled by God. Now, there's something interesting that takes place in these verses. In the first half of this psalm, in the first 10 verses, the personal pronouns I, me, and my are found over 20 times, while the names of God are only found 7 times. And then the last 10 verses, it sort of reverses. So his focus is very much on himself. He's very, very much feeling it. He's in the trouble, and we understand that. And he needs to get from one place to the other, but this is where he's at the moment. Someone has described the flow of thought of all of the psalm in these words, and I thought I'd just share them with you. This is not original with me. Verses 1 through 6 are sighing. Verses 7 through 10 is sinking. Verses 11 through 15 is singing. And verses 16 through 20 is soaring. I wish I could come up with great outlines like that, but I have to get them from someone else. But anyway, I thought that was a good summary. Because he does move from this place. This is not where he stays. This is not where he ultimately lands. But you can see his trouble. But he's still thinking about the Lord. And he says, I remember the Lord was troubled. Now, why is he troubled? Well, we're going to see a little bit of that later on. But basically, it comes down to this. I prayed, and God has not answered. I asked for some relief, and God has not granted it. I've asked for some understanding and wisdom, and I have not received it yet. So he's wondering why there hasn't been a response. Of all the things we deal with in our Christian life, that's one of the most difficult. We know God loves us. We know we're trying to live for him. We pray about things, and God does not always answer when we would like, and oftentimes he doesn't answer the way we would like him to answer. And how do we deal with that? And I'm glad this is in the Psalms to kind of help us understand that and be reassured by it. Verse 4, you hold my eyelids open, I am so troubled I cannot speak. There's various things that can keep you awake at night. You can be in pain. You can be something going on physically. But a lot of why we can't sleep at night is we get our mind in a certain place. I usually describe when I have those moments, I can't get my brain shut off. I wish I could find the off switch, but it's sort of like in high gear and keeps going over, especially if there's something that causes some anxiety or some trouble or whatever. I'm not telling you anything that you haven't experienced. And that's what he's experiencing. But I love the way he says it very picturesque. You hold my eyelids open. You're preventing me from closing my eyes in sleep. I'm so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. Now that's something he's going to come back to. So just kind of file that away, the old times, the ancient times, okay? I called to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. So it's this spinning over and over again, this turning over. I'm trying to search. I'm trying to figure out what this means, is what he says in the end of verse 6. I meditate within my heart. I'm thinking about me. I'm thinking about, and that's again another one of those moments when he's focused on self. He's thinking about himself. I call to remembrance my song in the night. Well, he's a musician by trade, all right? It's natural. He's going to go to a song. And if he lived in today's world, he'd put his earbuds in and, you know, get his phone out and play a few tunes probably. You know, my songs of the night, I'm rehearsing songs that, and maybe those were songs that once brought him some consolation and brought him some comfort, but now they're not having the desired effect. They're not really working well. And he's there. So, but the fact that, here's the first point. Even in his troubles, he doesn't abandon God, he turns toward God. Even in his troubles, he doesn't just say, it's not worth it. And basically, it comes down to this. And this is I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but I want to share this now. Be assured that God can, and be at peace with what God wills. Just because God doesn't mean that God can't. But we have to be at peace with whatever God wills. And leave that in his hands. You know, we're told in the New Testament that we're to cast all of our care upon the Lord, for he cares for us. That's a verse that you probably know about, right? You've heard that verse before. Maybe we've had it memorized. We know it. Maybe you got it tacked up somewhere, underlined in your Bible, highlighted somewhere. But how hard is that to do? To cast your cares on the Lord. Cast all your cares upon the Lord. Cast your cares upon the Lord. Cast your cares upon the Lord and then leave them there. Sometimes we cast them and then we just reel them right back in, you know. Okay, I'll cast again. There you go, Lord, take that. We pull it right back in and we just don't seem to get that where it needs to be. But start with this premise. This is the first step in this process. To know that even our troubles can bring us to the Lord. I suspect you just have to answer this for yourself. In the privacy of your own heart and your own memories, your own thoughts about yourself. Probably most of us would give testimony, I'm assuming, that there's been times when we've gone through some very troublesome times, but somehow through those troublesome times, you felt closer to the Lord than ever. Maybe it's because you didn't have anyone else to turn to. Maybe it's because you did as Asaph does. I stretched out my hands in the night. My eyelids are open. I'm crying out to you. I'm just telling you how I feel. But there's something about those difficulties that do draw us to himself. We're also told that in this world we will have troubles. We're also told that in this world we'll be hated. We should not be shocked that we have troubles in this world, although we almost always are when troubles come our way. But we shouldn't be shocked by that. Now, verses 7 and following, the turning to God now takes him to questions to God. And our questions to God will lead us to remember his truth. So it's all right to ask God questions. God is not obligated to answer our questions. God sometimes does not answer our questions. Sometimes we couldn't understand the answer if God gave us the answer to our questions. But God does welcome our questions. As long as we ask his questions about meaning and purpose and that sort of thing, but when we start questioning his motives, that's when God says, no, that's not the way it was. You remember Job? What a fascinating book Job is. What a strange, strange, strange story is the book of Job. You have this story of God and Satan having a little meeting, and Satan's accusing Job of, you know, this one, and basically God calls him out. Have you considered my servant Job? I mean, he's like, there's no one else like him. And Satan basically says, well, you've put a hedge around him. You've blessed him. You've given him everything anybody could want. Of course he's going to love you. You take it all away, he'll curse you to your face. And God allows Satan, and this is the sort of mind-blowing, God allows Satan to go so far in his family and his possessions, his health, all that's taken away. And you understand that he doesn't curse God, even when his wife gives him this wonderful grand advice, why don't you just curse God and die? That's words that never should be said to a depressed person, okay? But then his friends show up and spend chapter after chapter after chapter telling him, the only reason that troubles come is because of our sin. Therefore, troubles have come. You're a sinner. You just need to repent. And Job says, I don't know of anything I've done, in essence. I, you know, because they miss the point that sometimes trouble can come to even to the righteous. And then Job sort of loses it toward the end of the book. If God would just show up, I want to ask him some questions. And the edge is the where he steps over the edge. God, you haven't really treated me right here. And even though it's not correct, it's not proper, you and I can understand that feeling just a bit, right? And then God shows up and says, by the way, Job, I have some questions I want to ask you. And he asks him question after question after question after question after question after question after question. All the questions that Job has no answer for, and neither do we. And basically Job says, I'm just going to put my hand over my mouth. No more questions. So we don't question God's motive, but God invites us to just ask questions. And he begins by asking him some questions, beginning in verse 7. Now let's just look at them in list form. Will the Lord cast off forever? Question mark. And will he be favorable no more? Question mark. Has his mercy ceased forever? Question mark. Has his promise failed forevermore? Question mark. Has God forgotten to be gracious? Question mark. Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Question mark. Selah, think about this. Now, you already know the answer to all those questions, don't you? Those are not hard questions for us to answer, but in his experience, this is how it seems, this is how it feels. And God welcomes this question, and the questions somehow, even as improper as they are, as very understandable and plain are the answers we know, the asking of the questions is leading him in a path. So ask God your questions. He, as long as we don't question his motives, it's okay. Let's look at that list again. Will the Lord cast off forever? We talked about that this morning, did we not? We looked at that quote from Deuteronomy 31, verse 6, which the writer of Hebrews mentions there in chapter 13. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Therefore, we can boldly say the Lord is our helper. He's not going to cast off forever. He's not going to say, uh-oh, you're out. 3 strikes, you're out. 100 strikes, you're out. 1,000 strikes, you're out. I'm done with you. I don't anymore. And will be favorable no more? We could probably insert a New Testament word into that phrase. We could say, is he going to be gracious no more? Has the supply of his grace been exhausted? Is his amazing grace not quite so amazing anymore? Where is it? I don't see grace. We know the answer to that. And then he goes from grace to mercy in verse 8. Has his mercy ceased forever? Are we ever going to see any mercy? Are we going to see any relief? You know the answer to that, right? Has his promise failed forevermore? Notice what he's talking about. These are the grand themes of our relationship to God, okay? Is he going to abandon us? What about his grace? What about his mercy? What about his promises? He's covering all the biggies, right? Have your promises failed? Is that going to be the permanent thing? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has God just simply forgotten about us, that he's overlooking us, that he's just so busy that he can't look in on us? You know the answer to that. You know that's a negative response to that. Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? That tender mercies is a word that flows all through the Psalms. We could probably do a study on that before we're done in Psalms. It's the Hebrew word hesed or hesed, however you want to pronounce it. And it's described tender mercies or royal love. It's just a word of how God is so magnificent in his benevolence. He's way beyond anything we can imagine. So he's saying, in his anger, he shut up his tender mercies. The fact that God-like love, mercy, grace, benevolence, is that gone too? He asks those questions, and those questions moves him along. It moves him along to this place that he is. So now we're left with, where do we go from there? He's taken his troubles to the Lord. That's a good thing. He's asked his questions of the Lord. That's a good thing. It's obvious that he was assailed with doubts that find expression in these questions of unbelief. And he basically says this, verse 10, and I said, this is my anguish, and I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. Basically, to that point, the right hand of the Most High, he believes, has changed. From treating me well, blessing me, to now the blessings have dried up. Gracious and the grace is not seen. Mercy, the mercy is gone. The promises are something I've always stood upon and rested on. Now I don't see anything to stand on. So he's in a very bad place. He's in a very dark place. He needs someone to come to him and help him out. We don't need Job type, the Job friends type, but we need someone to come. But God's about to reach out and reorder his thinking. By the way, this is a characteristic. I know you're going to do another one of Psalms, one of Asaph's Psalms here in a few weeks, Pastor Adam. But that's sort of a similar format. This is bad. This is what I'm feeling. This is how I did. And then suddenly it all pivots and turns. That moment of sort of like the presence of God, like a cloudless moon rising over the ocean. You're suddenly bright and brilliant, and suddenly it's dazzling. You can't look away. And that's where he's about to get. That leads us to number three. The questions to God will lead us to remember God's truth. We're about to see that transition here in just a moment, which ultimately will lead us to the worship of God. All right? So let's go back to verse 10 and 11. And I said, this is my anguish. I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your works of old. I will meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God, the God who has done wonders? You have declared your strength among your people. And I'll stop there for just a moment. There's nothing in my life that's going right, he says. I feel terribly alone. I feel terribly unavailable to the resources that I thought I would get to God. I'm really discouraged. I can't sleep. I prayed to God and I haven't gotten an answer. I've asked my questions to the Lord, and it just, you know, the answers of my experience do not seem to match what I think they should be. So where's he going to go with that? If you can't understand and worship what's going on in the present, go back to the past, knowing that today will one day be seen in a different perspective. And we've all had that experience, haven't we? We're going through something now, and you don't understand until sometime later, and you look back and think, okay, now that makes some level of sense. God was able to get me through or get me out of or whatever it is. It's that backwards perspective where you can most clearly see what God has done. And we'll see that illustrated in a historical example here in just a moment. Remember this, that today is tomorrow's yesterday. Now that's a real profound thing to say, isn't it? Today is tomorrow's yesterday. But today we'll have the yesterday perspective someday, and you'll see today different than you see it now. So what does he do? To find some stability, he says, I'm going to go back to the past. I'm going to remember the works of the Lord, as he says in verse 11. He says, I remember the years, verse 10, the years of the right hand of the Most High. And you can almost hear if you can imagine a tune, a melody, and some harmony and some percussion behind this, you could probably almost hear that the emotion of the song starts to shift. Maybe it goes from a minor key to a major key. I don't know if that would be something they would do or not. But it suddenly starts to get a little more upbeat, a little more encouraging, a little bit of a different tone. He says in verse 12, I will meditate on all your work, and talk of all your deeds. Okay, I'm stuck here where I'm at in the present. I do not have the perspective of tomorrow that will make today a yesterday. So the only thing I can do is let me look back into the past and find something about you that I know to be true. I'll meditate on your work. I'll talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Now, sanctuary was a place where people like Asaph hung out in the temple of God, in the tabernacle of God, and where God was worshipped. And he understood, but he was understanding that the tabernacle of God, the sanctuary here, is my time with God. I'm going to get back and spend time with him. Who is so great a God as our God? Now, there's the first question that he answers that really is helpful and encouraging. By the way, if you have questions, that might be a good question to supplant the other questions. Lord, why am I feeling so alone? Why am I feeling so down? Why am I feeling whatever it is? Maybe we should ask the question, who is so great a God as our God? That's an easy one to answer, isn't it? There is no one like our God. He is supreme. He is above all. He is the only true and living God. He is the God who made everything, the God who sustains everything, who will judge everything, who will destroy everything and remake everything so that his redeemed will enjoy a glorious environment purified from all that is evil and wrong and corrupt. That's the God who is. You are the God who does wonders, verse 14. Who does wonders. You've declared your strength among the peoples. Now he's starting to think differently, because the questions about, you know, where's your mercy? Where's your grace? Where's your answer to prayer? Okay, I'm going to think of you in the sanctuary. I'm going to think about your work. Who's a God like you? None. And let's just go back and think about the past. Verse 15. You have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. Selah. Another breaking point. Okay, we're now right about to pivot to a point where now he's going to really focus on what he needs to be focused. And basically his whole, can we say it this way? His whole mental health episode that he's experiencing in Psalm 77 is going to go from one of despair to one of worship, all because he changes his mental and his spiritual perspective about who God is and what God is doing. And as I said earlier, remember I said there was 20-plus references to himself in the first part, and then it becomes pretty much all about God going forward, you and, oh God, and so forth, all right? And he mentions at the end of 15, the sons of Jacob and Joseph, all right? So this takes us back to a particular period in Israel's history, the time of the Exodus, okay? Because it was the sons of Jacob, 12 tribes, 12 sons, 12 tribes, and particularly Joseph, who preserved them in Egypt while that terrible period of starvation was going on and so forth. And then they were enslaved. And then Moses comes along and God meets him at the burning bush. And you know the rest of the story, right? You remember the contest with Pharaoh and so forth. By the way, this thing about history, he gives one little episode of history in 16 through 20. But if you look at Psalm 78, I'm not going to preach through Psalm 78 because it goes on for a long time, all 72 verses of it. So I'm not going to do that tonight. But basically, it becomes now an expanded view of Israel's history, of reminding them again and again of how God intervened and God did amazing things. But he's going to have just one little episode from Israel's history, verses 16 through 17. And this is what's leading him to worship. So here's, let me just back up and say this again. All right? The troubles of heart, turn it over, go back to God. Let it lead you to God. Ask your questions. If we ask questions, we're going to find out the only answer has to come from God. There is no other person but him. There is no God like him. And since we don't have perspective on today that we will have tomorrow on today, let's look back at a former day and see how God worked then. And that's what he's about to do. Verse 16. I love the poetry of it, by the way. The waters saw you, O God. The waters saw you and were afraid. I never thought of waters being afraid, did you? I never thought of waters seeing God, but he puts it in sort of a personification. Well, what waters is he talking about? Well, you're going to find out what waters he's talking about. I already gave you the hint. We're talking about Exodus, right? So I've already spoiled it, all right? There's no more surprise here. The depths also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies sent out a sound. And your arrows also flashed about. The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Now, the crossing of the Red Sea does not really describe a storm. Okay, it says they walked away when God parted the Red Sea, and they went across it, and Pharaoh's army was stayed by God's power from pursuing him for a while, and they walked along on dry land. So where did the storm come from? We would assume that when the chariots of Pharaoh go down into the Red Sea, not only did the waters close over them, God sent this tempest, this storm, the lightning, the rain, and so forth, that God just basically unloaded the entire atmospheric disturbance of his presence upon them and defeated them. So that must be what he's sounding about. But the clouds poured out their water. The sky sent out a sound. So it is feelable. It's in sound. The air is flashed around, sort of like lightning. They saw it. They felt it in their bodies. The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Basically, he's going to a place where he says, God, I don't even hear you. I don't see you. I don't know you. Thinking about a God that everybody heard and everybody saw and everybody felt and everybody knew that God had shown up. Your way was in the sea. Your path in the great waters. Your footsteps were not known. I'm going to come back to that for just a moment. But you were there. You were there in the sea. Your path was in the great waters. It was you who unleashed the clouds and the storm and the lightning and the sound and shook the earth. You did all that. You were there. You were involved. And I find my encouragement, and we should as well, in the fact that God can. As I said earlier, we need to be assured that God can. And we need to be at peace with whatever God wills. God doesn't always show up and part the waters in some dramatic display. God doesn't always heal the sick. God doesn't always give us some miracle. But you know what? If nothing else, we need to be reminded of Scripture and in our own experience, looking back, that God indeed is able and God indeed can, and we can count on Him. Be assured that God can. Be at peace with what God wills. When we can't understand and worship in the present, go back to the past, knowing that today we will today will one day be seen in the perspective of the past. Today is indeed tomorrow's yesterday, and that's the perspective we have. All right? Now, I love this in the end of 19. Your footsteps were not known. Get the picture of this. Yeah, they knew God was at work, but they didn't see Him. They didn't see Him in visible form. They saw the effects of His power, but they didn't see Him. They couldn't see the footprints of God going across that land at the bottom of the Red Sea. They couldn't see the footprints of God on the other side, on either side of that body of water. But they nonetheless were there. You know, in our lives, we maybe never see the footsteps of God beside us. But we need to believe that they're there and know that they're there. They were not known. Verse 20, you led your people like a flock. And sheep was something they knew all about, all right? We might be driving down some country road, and, oh, look, there's some sheep over there on the hillside. Aren't they cute and all that sort of thing? But that was a major part of their livelihood, a major part of their economy, and so forth. And it says, you fled your people like a flock. This vast herd, you brought them through. You protected them by the hand of Moses and Aaron. And then the psalm abruptly stops. It's kind of like, shouldn't there be like some grand, what is you put on the end of a song that's kind of like a big ending? A what? A finale, crescendo. You can say a few more words. I don't know what they mean. If you like, that'll be fine. But do you think it's like some big ending? Spurgeon, in his wonderful book, A Treasury of David, even though this isn't a David psalm, he writes in that, I was exposed to this earlier today, so I was thinking about this again. But Spurgeon said he believes that there's an abrupt ending in 77 because he wants you to go right into 78, where he talks about, give ear, my people, to my law, and ears to the words of my mouth, and I will open my mouth in a parable. And then he goes in and talks about Jacob. He talks about Egypt. He talks about, you know, this multi-verse kind of lengthy song about all the history of God providing, and he wants to remind us of that. But you do get the idea that in Psalm 77, in fact, he was encouraged. Could you go flip back two slides? I want you to see all three of these again, and I just want to summarize one more time. Hopefully this will be of help to you. The way out of trouble is simply this. The troubles of the heart can and should lead us to God. He does, even in his anguish. Number two, our questions to God will lead us to remember God's truth, to think about Him. And thirdly, God's truth can lead us to the worship of God and have perspective on today that we can't usually have because we're looking at what God has done in the past. Not only do we have to go back to the Exodus and to the pages of the Bible, although, well, we should, but we can also go back in the moments of our life where God has sustained us. God has taken us through. If nothing else, we're still here, right? God has seen fit to give us this day, and God has given us opportunities to gather for worship and to love Him and to serve Him and to give to His work and honor Him in prayer and our attention to the Word of God. So we need to look back even in our own lives. And maybe there's been some special moments in our lives that we maybe just need to archive in our own mind that we would just remember that. I'll read this little quote. I don't really know who to give credit for it, but I thought it was a good summary of this psalm. Joyless days of trouble and sleepless nights of despair plagued the psalmist. Why? Not because of unbelief, but because of faith. Because he believed the Lord, he wrestled with himself and with God. He cannot understand why the Lord did not keep his promises and deliver his people from bondage. What do you do in a situation like that? That's what I just shared with you. Let your troubles take you back to God. And as they take you back to God, let your questions lead you to the truth, and let the truth lead you to worship, even as it does for him.